It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury in for Ben Kiefer. It's a News Buzz edition of the show where we host short conversations on Iowa news of the week. Coming up in a few minutes, I'll talk with Des Moines Register political columnist Kathy Obradovich about her reporting on vice presidential candidate Tim Kaine's visit to Iowa. And later in the show, we'll hear from the Iowa Policy Project's research director who spoke at a forum last night on a potential increase to Linn County's minimum wage. This week, a West Des Moines 18-year-old took a plea deal for a charge of assault with intent to commit serious injury. Just a side note, that plea means he admits no guilt, but acknowledges the prosecution had enough evidence to convict him. Nicholas Fifield was charged in December with sex abuse of a person suffering from a mental defect or incapacity which precludes giving consent. He was accused of sexual assault of a mentally ill group home resident. Here to help us understand what the larger theme of this case is, Alan Heisterkamp, Director of the Mentors in Violence Program, Leadership Institute, and Center for Violence Prevention at the University of Northern Iowa. Alan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Emily. Great to be with you.
Well, as much as you can, help us understand what allegedly happened in this case. If I understand it right, Fifield had the permission of the young woman's caregivers and her parents to take her to a movie, yet that date didn't play out as originally planned.
Right. Well, yeah, it's obviously a very difficult situation for these families and the entire West Des Moines community, you know, to grapple with and to read about in the paper, and certainly those closest to the parties involved here. Your heart goes out to them and all that, you know, all the family and friends who, you know, support them. You know, in terms of making sense or looking at the big picture, is this is a pretty typical example, if you will, of the sexual assault or the alleged crime of sexual assault. In other words, these two parties were not strangers. There was some familiarity on the part of both the young man and the young woman, and basically, it sounds like or it looks like. Consent and perhaps agreement to be intimate was not mutual, and there wasn't maybe the boundaries or the lines of respect forwarded to, in this case, the young girl. Those are certainly the, you know, just my perceptions from the outside looking in. But it's probably more typical than not, and we shouldn't be surprised, I don't think, particularly, Emily, by the comments by the judge, who said that this young man, that jail time or prison time would do this young man no good.
That was a Polk County attorney, John Sarcone, who said prison would not do this kid any good. Is that what you're referring to? Yeah.
Right, correct. And, you know, I know that, you know, as a society, we really don't want to or don't see ourselves in the practice of wanting to slap federal charges or assign prison time to adolescents, because I believe that at the time that this alleged crime took place, the young man was 17 years of age. But we also, as a society, are not really committed to education and prevention programming in our schools or in our communities, and getting training and education to young men and young women about healthy relationships and how to prevent these types of situations from happening. We're not there yet as a society. And on the other side, when we look at other crimes committed by other adolescents, oftentimes of a different race, other crimes, jail time does seem appropriate. So I think we send mixed messages. Our legal system can, and leaders in those positions can send mixed messages to, our young men and our communities about which crimes are to be taken serious and which crimes aren't.
Well, that's an interesting point, and it kind of goes into my next question, which is about, people who are involved, young men who are involved in sports, sometimes get treated differently in the media. There's a perception that they're treated differently. And I was wondering, you know, several outlets, news outlets that reported on this case did emphasize Fifield's involvement in his high school tennis team. And this struck me as similar to the case from Stanford last year, where people were upset that there was a lot of focus on the successful swimming times of the convicted rapist in that case. When you see those headlines in the media involved in these cases, you know, how does that affect you? How do you see those?
Well, initially, they act as a distraction and kind of take our eyes off of the real issue, and that is that there has been a victim of a crime or alleged crime, and then there's been a perpetrator of a crime. And, you know, the titles or, you know, how the public is introduced to these parties, particularly the Stanford swimmer that you reference and the young man from West Des Moines, that the, you know, the athletic background and prowess really serve to, again, distract. And what we should be doing is looking at the behaviors and looking at the crime that was committed or alleged to have committed, and ask ourselves, what could we have done in front of that or before that to have increased the likelihood that that didn't take place or that wouldn't take place? And that's the part that the center here at Northern Iowa really wants to continue to broaden and deepen those discussions with high schools, secondary schools, but also college campuses as well.
Well, tell me a little bit more of that, because as you kind of mentioned, you were awarded a grant not too long ago to help prevent sexual violence. And I believe you're working with coaches, teachers. That must be helpful. You know, tell me a little bit about what you're doing there.
Right. So the center at UNI here applied for and received Ralliance Grant, which are monies being directed through the National Center for Violence Prevention. Emily, these are monies that were committed by the National Football League, the NFL, to be used for community organizations and nonprofits to apply for funding to look at strategies and programming, innovative programming, to reduce the incidences of sexual assault, increase relationships amongst young men, young women, and we were awarded a grant. And our plans are, our strategy is to, we're going to partner with, or we are partnering with, the Iowa High School Athletic Association and also the Iowa Coalition Against Sexual Assault to offer coaching boys into men training to coaches. So if any coaches are out there listening to this program today, be watching for advertisements to where you can come and get trained in how to implement the Coaching Boys into Men program with your athletes in your school or in your community. And it really has a targeted focus on taking using our young men in those positions, oftentimes positions of leadership and status within a school culture or community, and really engaging their influence, their leadership, in helping raise awareness about sexual assault and helping hold each other accountable to really maximizing and keeping relationships on a positive nature. So identifying healthy relationships, identifying the warning signs of unhealthy relationships, and also practicing active bystander education, bystander strategies and techniques to, again, hold themselves and each other accountable. And it's a successful program. It has been tested and is an evidence-based, has roots in Iowa. We were part of the pilot study back in 2007 with several of our coaches across Iowa and also into Nebraska and South Dakota, who really piloted this model. And so here we are today, you know, 2016, really being the beneficiaries of work that's been going on to address these really delicate, challenging issues. We don't want to point fingers at men and boys, because most men and young men are not violent, nor do they want to, you know, hurt or harm others. But we need to leverage their influence them. We need to really help them be better role models to others so that we can, you know, really what happened in Des Moines or in Stanford or countless other examples that we can really minimize and maybe one day, you know, end those behaviors from occurring.
And what age should we be reaching out to young men at? Because, you know, we've been focusing a lot as a nation, as a state, on the college level. But as we see in this case, an 18-year-old, you know, college might be too late to educate people on what sexual assault is and how to prevent it. So what age should we be reaching young men and women?
Well, you're exactly right. You know, what colleges are really stepping up efforts to have these conversations, particularly now as school starts here in the fall. Here at Northern Iowa just last night, working with a group of 100 underclassmen who will be helping welcome the first-year students here at UNI and how to have a successful start to the school year, because we know that in this topic or in this particular area, 1 in 5, 1 in 4 young women on college campuses are likely to be sexually assaulted. And you're right. If we want college campuses to be safe, we need to reach and partner with our colleagues in the secondary school level, middle school and high school, and start having these conversations earlier, which is what the Coaching Boys to Men program and also the MVP, the Mentors of Violence Prevention model, do. But here's the challenging part is that, unfortunately, because it's so prevalent and our young boys are, skilled and very comfortable with being online and having access to technology, unfortunately, young men, as young boys, 10, 11 years of age, are intersecting with pornographic images, other aspects of pornography that are very prolific. And so our young boys, older elementary-aged young men and girls, are interfacing and experiencing and seeing things that just are confusing and don't make sense to them, but there's not necessarily the immediate resources there at the time to help this young man understand, learn from what he just experienced or just saw. And so young men form these attitudes and behaviors about women, about girls, that are pretty skewed and skewed from that, again, from the perspective of pornography. And that's one major example. And that's something that we're going to have to, as a society and as educators and parents, as faith community, we're going to have to really buckle down and ask ourselves, what are we going to do to counter and to address that learning what our young men are experiencing with regards to pornography. We're not there yet as a society, but there are some examples where, I think where people are starting to, look at that and say, what can we do and how can we counteract this?
Alan, thanks for helping us understand this case and the larger issues it brings to light. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Alan Heisterkamp is the director of the Mentors in Violence Prevention Leadership Institute and Center for Violence Prevention at the University of Northern Iowa. It's River to River. It's a News Buzz edition of the show. I'm Emily Woodbury. This week, Democratic vice presidential candidate Tim Kaine visited Cedar Rapids for a planned rally, and then he took a detour for a surprise visit to the state fair. Here to discuss the rally and the political power of the fair during an election season is political columnist for the Des Moines Register, Kathy Obradovich. Kathy, hello. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Emily.
All right, so let's start with the rally you attended in Cedar Rapids. What was the crowd like? Who was there?
So it was about 300 people, which I think is a relatively small crowd for a presidential campaign at Kirkwood Community College. There were a lot of educators in the audience, the kind of union support and others. I had been to a Clinton rally in Des Moines the week before, a much bigger crowd and a very diverse crowd. This Tim Kaine crowd was quite a bit smaller, and also I think more older people and more of the sort of hardcore Democrats that you would normally see go to everything.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned there was some union talk. What was Kaine's message or messages that he was really focusing on?
I think that one of the big messages that Tim Kaine was trying to bring to Iowa was that people cannot trust Donald Trump to be commander-in-chief. He continued some of the remarks that he had made earlier about how Trump has gone after the Gold Star family, the Khan family, who had lost their son he was killed in action in the army, and also tried to make the connection between Trump not paying or not disclosing his tax returns and suggesting that he hasn't been paying his fair share of taxes, which of course support the military and veterans. So I think he made the point that Iowa is one of the closest battleground states, and in fact a new poll shows that Clinton has only a 2 percentage point lead over Donald Trump right now in Iowa. And so he's looking for ways to reach out to people who may be undecided, and people who are not hardcore Democrats or Republicans, and dealing with veterans issues is a good way to do that.
Yeah, I thought that was so interesting. You reported that Kaine said that Iowa was one of the tightest races in the country. And I thought that was interesting because in Iowa, as you mentioned, there's kind of a smaller gap between projections of votes for Clinton and Trump. But then in Florida, the latest polls are showing Clinton with a 9-point lead over Trump. And in Virginia, Clinton's leading by 14 points.
Yeah. So the folks who did the poll, Quinnipiac University, they point to the fact that Iowa is predominantly a white voter state. So the vast majority of the population is white. Most of the voting base is white. And where Clinton is getting her advantage over Trump in places like Florida is with minority voters, who just don't exist in Iowa in any appreciable numbers. Clinton is leading with women in Iowa, but she's losing independents and younger voters to Trump. And so I think it's a more difficult race in the sense that you're having to identify voters that aren't quite so obviously Republican or Democrat.
Mm-hmm. And that the gender gap that you mentioned, that Iowa women tend to favor Clinton and Iowa men tend to favor Trump, according to the numbers. Do you think that's just here in Iowa, or is that just a reflection of what's going on across the country?
Definitely a reflection of what's going on around the country. One of the things that's interesting is if you look at the Iowa Senate race, Patty Judge, the Democrat challenger to Chuck Grassley, the incumbent Republican, women are virtually tied between Grassley and Judge. So, you can't, say that women in Iowa are necessarily all going to vote for Clinton because she's a woman, or that they're all going to vote for her because she's a Democrat, because that is certainly not what's happening in the Senate race.
Mm-hmm. I'm talking with Kathy Obradovich. She's a political columnist for the Des Moines Register. And earlier this month, Kathy, you wrote a column titled "Tim Kaine Really Is America's Stepdad," and you spoke at length with Kaine's friend and law school roommate Dave Miles from Dallas Center. Do you think so? Is it being a stepdad a very likable thing?
I think the way Dave Miles was putting it, that he's likable, he's earnest, he is trying to be your friend. Dave Miles definitely not putting any sort of negative spin on it, like some of the comedians have talking about Tim Kaine being sort of a dorky, friendly kind of guy. I think that the State Fair was actually a good place for Tim Kaine to campaign because he is a good retail campaigner. He can make connections with people one-on-one. He's a friendly sort of guy. And also, I think he's got that sort of wholesome aura about him that plays well at the State Fair.
Mm-hmm. Well, he showed up unexpectedly, a surprise visit to the fair. Do you think this was strategic, or was he just craving some fried food and a pork chop?
Well, I can't discount the power of the pork chop on a stick. but I think that the reason that they didn't pre-announce his visit was basically a security thing. He's under mm-hmm. Secret Service protection. If it is a unannounced visit, the necessity of them controlling who is there at the fairgrounds is less. So, so I think that that was basically, you know, President Obama had done the same thing at previous fairs, and that's just the way they can manage somebody who's under that protection. But, you know, so why go to the fair? It's a great place to be seen. It's a way to kind of present the candidate as a personality as opposed to something that is going to be all about heavy issues and positions. You know, this time of year, people are not necessarily thinking about, you know, the 7-point plan to fix the economy. They're thinking about getting some fried food on a stick. And so this is an opportunity for the candidate to be part of that kind of fun atmosphere at the end of the summer.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Patty Judge, who was also at the Iowa State Fair this week. I'm wondering, you know, she was speaking on the soapbox, and Senator Grassley, who she's running against, declined to speak on the soapbox. The soapbox seems to have some obvious advantages, but are there some potential drawbacks or risks? Any reason not to do it?
I was a little surprised that Grassley did not choose to speak on the soapbox, because he has done it in the past and has been well received in the past. I think that there has been times, especially during the presidential campaign, but there have been some state Iowa candidates who have been heckled. There are some interest groups in Iowa that have been kind of aggressive in past years at actually, you know, shouting back at candidates, whatever. But we didn't really see that this year at the fair. Even Congressman Steve King, who is, you know, a controversial figure in politics in Iowa, had, you know, a good crowd at the soapbox and had no problems. So there may have been some concern that Grassley would be a target for that kind of activity, but we just haven't seen it this year at the fair.
All right. Well, Kathy Obradovich, Des Moines Register political columnist, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thanks for having me, Emily.
You're listening to River on Iowa Public Radio News. Coming up after a break, I will talk with an economic researcher about a proposed hike to Linn County's minimum wage. And I'll sit down with Luke Benson of the Iowa Music Project, whose album featuring Iowa musicians is ready for release. That's coming up in a few minutes. And coming up on Monday's show, Ben Kiefer will be back in the host seat talking with University of Iowa President Bruce Harreld as he and his office prepare for the upcoming semesters. And Ben will ask Harreld to reflect on his first year in the office as well as his vision for the next. The conversation will happen live, so you'll be able to call or email in with your questions. You can get those questions in now at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. That's coming up on Monday at noon on River to River, and we'll be back in just a few minutes. I'm Emily Woodbury. This is River to River from IPR News. Good afternoon. You're joining us midstream on River to River. It's a News Buzz edition of the program. I'm Emily Woodbury in for Ben Kiefer. Linn County Board of Supervisors Chairman Ben Rogers unveiled a plan this week to increase the minimum wage in the county by $1 a year for 3 years. The minimum wage is currently $7.25 an hour, and under this proposal, it would be $10.25 by January of 2019. Last night, they held a public forum to discuss the impact of this plan. And Iowa Policy Project Research Director Peter Fisher was there. He joins me now to discuss this plan and the forum. Hi, Peter. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Glad to be here.
So give me an idea. When was the last time the minimum wage was raised in Linn County?
Well, it would have been the last time the state raised it, which was January 1st, 2008. 8.5 years ago, it went up to $7.25.
Okay, and as we know, inflation continues to increase each year. So people are pretty involved in this. Tell us about the forum. To what extent were people on the same page? Was there a lot of division?
There was some division, but I think by and large the panelists in the audience were supportive. Some people asking why the Board of Supervisors didn't increase it more quickly, some having some reservations, but I think on the whole the momentum was certainly in favor of the increases proposed by Supervisor Rogers.
Mm-hmm. Although then, you know, restaurant owners or business owners on the other side a little bit concerned about the cost. I read that a restaurant owner at the forum last night was expressing concern over the ripple effect of raising the minimum wage. He was saying this would be on consumers then. He gave the example of a $10 burger becoming $10.50. And I'm curious, earlier this year, you and your team at the Iowa Policy Project, you studied the impact of raising the minimum wage in Linn County specifically. What do we know, what does the research say about whether consumers making more money leads them to spend more money?
Well, that's been the finding of a great deal of research over the past 10 or 20 years. The minimum wage is a topic that's been studied heavily by economists. And one of the main reasons why the studies generally show little or no effect on employment is because the minimum wage, while it does obviously raise costs to employers of low-wage workers, it also puts a great deal of money in the pockets of those workers who turn around and spend much of that in the local economy, boosting sales, which tends to offset the effect of the increase in costs.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm curious, this proposal comes a few months after Linn County's board appointed minimum wage working group, after Linn County's board appointed minimum wage working group recommended supervisors raise the minimum to $8.25 in January of next year. And this recommendation included a caveat that the group would push lawmakers for a statewide increase and reconvene again after the next year's legislative session. Can you tell me, what do you think the likelihood is of action from the legislature on this?
I really don't know. I don't have a good guess on whether they're going to take it up. I'm doubtful because they've had plenty of opportunities over the past several years, and it hasn't even been brought up in the Iowa House, so I'm not sure why it would be this time around.
Mm-hmm. Well, how much, from what you know, would the minimum wage need to be on a statewide level to be caught up with inflation? Do we know that?
Well, if we go back to a longer stretch of time, to 1968, when the minimum wage in terms of its purchasing power was at its peak, it'd have to be close to $11 by now to keep pace with inflation since then.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we only have about a minute left, but very briefly, what's next for Linn County? What's the next step?
Well, the next step is for the county supervisors to take up the proposal that Supervisor Rogers has put out there for a dollar increase a year over the next 3 years, and to see if they think that's going to fly, and to see if it needs to be faster or whatever. But I think that's the next thing to happen.
All right. Iowa Policy Project Research Director Peter Fisher. Peter, thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Emily Woodbury in for Ben Kiefer. This week, Sarah-Gordo County supervisors voted unanimously to not recommend construction of a hog confinement facility in the northern part of the county. River Edge Farms proposed the facility, which would have housed nearly 5,000 hogs. Here with me to talk about the proposal and the decision to recommend a denial of the project is Sarah-Gordo County Supervisor Jay Erdahl. Hi, Jay. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much, Emily. Appreciate that.
So, Jay, you met on Tuesday with community members, with your fellow supervisors, to talk about this proposal for the facility. What influenced your decision to vote against the hog confinement facility?
Well, Emily, as I saw it, the siting of the confinement was the real problem for me. It was within a mile and a half to a half a mile of five different wildlife centers, which had the potential of being a real problem. And in addition to that, there was also a small creek called Kalmus Creek, which kind of winds its way across the county and eventually comes into Mason City and dumps into the Winnebago River. having that creek in such close proximity was really a worrisome factor.
There were representatives from farm agencies there as well. It sounds like they weren't able to quell any of your concerns or community member concerns.
Well, there was real difficulty with the siting of the project, and regardless of how much they conform to the matrix, which is the formula used to site a facility, it was very difficult to get around the fact that within a mile and a half to a half mile, there were five different wildlife centers. And in addition to that, there's a creek, Calmus Creek, which runs very near to where the proposed facility was going to be. And that creek meanders through Saratoga County and eventually dumps into the Winnebago River in Mason City. So those are real issues that we had when we were looking at this project.
Mm-hmm. So would you consider a proposal for a site elsewhere in the county? Is there anywhere else where this facility could go?
Most of our sites are in the southern half of the county for a couple reasons. The topography, the land is much more suitable for them down in the southern part of the county. There's much less population down there, and there's always the opportunity for any producer to bring forward a proposal, and the Board of Supervisors will entertain that.
And have you heard from people who currently live near hog confinement facilities about the quality of their air, about how and if this impacted the cost of their property? Have you heard from other people in Iowa to get some perspective on this?
Well, actually, there were some neighbors there who actually farm and had objections, not because they object to farming, but because of the nature and scope of the project, it would tend to negatively impact their homes and their quality of life. Now, obviously, we've seen across the state of Iowa a number of hog confinements rejected, particularly in Webster County and in Floyd County. And the basic theme is always the same: air and water quality plus quality of life. Those are always key components to any rejection. It becomes kind of a stigma that you are now you're interested in hog confinement. So we have nothing against agriculture. We're strong supporters of agriculture in Saratoga County, but it needs to be properly sited, and that's where the problem was with the project north of Ventura.
Mm-hmm. What about those who spoke in favor of the proposal? Could you see their point of view? What were they saying about the benefit this would bring to the county and the community?
Well, they didn't really talk about the benefit it would bring to the county and the community, to be very honest. Their explanations were basically, or comments were basically, that they qualified under the matrix scoring, and therefore they should be granted the permit to build. And we pointed out that we have a number of other things that occur when someone wants to build a facility besides the matrix, which is a scoring system.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be something we put in place a number of years ago, which is called the Good Neighbor Policy, where you reach out to your neighbors in the vicinity and you speak to them concerning the possible effects on them of any type of hog confinement that might be built. That had not been done. There was no berming that was going to be done either around the facility. When you have trees, honeysuckle bush, etc., it just helps in many ways keep the odor suppressed. And none of that had been planned. So I think that there's a perception out there that only the matrix matters, and short of that, other measures are not important. And I think they are. I mean, I think it's very important, and we've had a number of facilities in the county, take into account the berming and the vegetation growth around their facilities and the good neighbor policy, and it has been a benefit, a real benefit to their relations with their neighbors and the siting of their project.
Now, you and your fellow Cerro Gordo County supervisors voted to not recommend this, the construction of this facility, but if I understand this correctly, this recommendation is now going to the Iowa Department of Natural Resources, which has the final say. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct. The Department of Natural Resources can overrule the county at any time. They have the authority to.
All right. Well, we will wait to see how the Iowa DNR rules on your recommendation. Cerro Gordo County Supervisor Jay Erdahl, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Emily, thank you very much.
Interesting enough, a related story coming from central Iowa. After a public hearing in Des Moines yesterday, the Iowa Economic Development Authority Board voted 8-1, approving nearly $1.5 million in state tax credits for the proposed Prestige Foods pork processing plant near Eagle Grove. It's a reminder that the debate over pork processing plants is an ongoing issue far from being settled, and we'll continue to cover the issue here on River to River. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Emily Woodbury. And finally, an update on a project we've been following on NewsBuzz and Talk of Iowa, the Iowa Music Project. It's an effort to promote and support Iowa musicians. And this year, the organization developed a songwriting showcase asking artists across the state to submit original music. The results of that project have been compiled into a CD that will be released next Friday. Here with me to preview the album and talk about the process is Luke Benson. He's the director of the Iowa Music Project, and he's here with me in the studio. Hi, Luke.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. How are you doing? Are you feeling some closure? This is exciting. This project has come together.
Yeah, this project was the first half of my 2016, so yeah, closure is the right word for it. So.
All right. Well, tell me a little bit about what you were looking for. So, you know, there's 20 tracks on the CD you're releasing next Friday, 27 in the digital download online. How did you come across these artists?
Right. Well, the goal of the project was to get a better understanding of what the Iowa music sound is. A traditional sort of knee-jerk guess at what that would be folk music, and that's certainly part of the story. But there are a lot of experimental musicians that are making interesting music. I used to teach at Kirkwood and had international students that were making really, you know, interesting music here in Iowa City. There's a budding hip-hop scene in Des Moines. So our goal with the project was try to sort of expand and explore the diversity of sound being made. The way that we did that was essentially partnering with several different music organizations throughout the state to try to put this together. Flat Black Studios out in Lone Tree, Little Village in Iowa City, Des Moines Social Club in Des Moines, and Maximum Ames out of Ames. And with those sort of geographic reach, we did our best to sort of promote this idea of sharing your sound, whether it be country, death metal, rock, acid jazz. Like, if, you know, the whole idea was that it's a showcase, not a contest. And so we just did a sort of promotion beginning January 1st, running through March 15th, and Little Village hosted and curated a site where people could submit songs, and it would be updated on a weekly basis. And by the time the showcase submission was done, we had over 250 submissions.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's hard to whittle down. Yeah. So going through all of that music, do you think you can answer the question, can you describe Iowa sound?
No. I mean, it's it's, you know, Iowa, it's got the reputation, I suppose, for being like a flyover state, but we're interesting. We're across the board. We're incredibly varied in a lot of different ways, and that demonstrated itself in the music, too. So.
Mm-hmm. So when you were conceiving of this album, did you see it as kind of a whole album or more of a playlist? A kind of, I'm thinking of the Guardians of the Galaxy soundtrack. What did they call that? The most awesome mixtape, you know?
Mixtape. That's what I said all along. You know, I mean, I'm a kid of the 90s, well, technically 80s, but when I started making mixtapes, it was 90s. And that was really the spirit that I was going into with this. I wanted to make the best, most interesting, eclectic mixtape that I could. And I think we did that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, and we're seeing bigger bands come into Iowa. I mean, actually coming up next week, Lake Street Dive's coming here. And, of course, Bridget, the bassist, is from Iowa, but
right?
they've
yeah.
become a huge name. And we do get very big names coming here. I mean, what do you see happening to the Iowa music scene in 10, 15 years?
Oh, boy. Well, if I'm honest, part of the reason for establishing the nonprofit Iowa Music Project was based on, I don't know if cynicism is the right word, or maybe concern, because the music industry is changing a lot, and it's changed a lot over the last 15 years. It's incredibly difficult for artists to, sustain themselves just across the board, which is why we founded this organization. So I think as long as local communities and funding organizations like the Iowa Arts Council, who, you know, made this project possible, continue to get behind and support artists and organizations that are doing this, it's going to continue to be more and more vibrant. But if they don't, we're going to lose live music. And maybe that's too gloom and doom, but that was kind of the basis for why I started this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, live music is very much the backbone of a musician's career now.
Mm-hmm.
What are some other tracks that you want to feature that you want to talk about here?
Sure. I think one that will be surprising to people is Victor Ayara's Mafina Ibaha. Victor was originally born in Nigeria and lived there 30, maybe 40 years, and then came to Des Moines, which is where he's out of. And this is sort of a Cumbria kind of Afro jazz, sort of Fela Kuti kind of sound, and it's so much fun and so interesting and so not what you would expect at all. So I think that'll be a standout track for a lot of people. Vanessa Ellsbury submitted, and she's a young woman who submitted this, it sounds like right out of the 70s psychedelic era, the song called Lay Me Down. OH is going to be a surprise and a challenging track for some folks. It's a 5.5-minute experimental jazz piece that features drums and Kurt Oren playing saxophone. That's sort of the attitude that people that get the CD and listen to it, it's eclectic and across the board, and there's probably going to be some tracks people will naturally fall in love with, some they may just want to skip, and others that will grow on them over time with repeated listening. And I think OH is one of those that maybe at first is a little hard to get into, but there's some really just fascinating moments there.
I hate to ask this question because, you know, I'm like we said at the outset, you know, you put all this work into this and that's finally coming to fruition, but, you know, we always are looking what's next. So what's next for the Iowa Music Project? Do you have any plans?
We've got several different plans. We're going to be doing some pretty aggressive fundraising from now until the end of October in the hopes of raising matching funds for another Iowa Arts Grant. And if we're able to do that, I am currently developing partnerships and working out the details to try to do a series of animated music videos of Iowa songs. And the idea would be to select 12 different artists and 12 different songs and work with either, you know, state or, you know, either have a person from Iowa do the animation or the artist singing be from Iowa. But basically put together a DVD of original animated videos. So that's something that we're working to put together. We've also got a series of podcasts that we've started that highlight venues and venue owners throughout the state and kind of tells the story of the people behind the scenes who keep making the music happen. So those are the two that are on the front burner, and we've got lots of fun plans for music education for low-income kids and all of that as things that we're always working on as well. So just stay tuned and see what we come up with next, I guess.
Very cool. Well, we will. Luke Benson, director of the Iowa Music Project, thank you so much for coming in.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And if listeners want to get more information on the Iowa Music Project and this album that's being released next Friday, where can they go?
IowaMusicProject.com is our website. You can like us on Facebook. I'm not very good at Twitter yet, but I'm working on it. And the album is on sale through Maximum Ames. So if you go to their website, you should be able to find us, no problem.
All right. Yeah. Thanks again, Luke.
Yep.
And we're going to go out of the show today with this track, State Lines by Elizabeth Moen.
He got too much stuff and I can't quit my job. The last box in and my heart starts throbbing. Got a lump in my throat. It's gonna burst out. You give me one last hug, but I can't help but stop. Well, don't you?
Coming up on Monday's River to River, Ben Kiefer will interview President Bruce Harreld. You can send your questions for the University of Iowa president to River to River at iowapublicradio.org. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Dennis Reese. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Emily Woodbury.